The great Black writer, Zora Neale Hurston.
She just doesn't see any barriers, doesn't see a river that she can't manage to cross over. And she just does her own thing at a time when few women did, at a time when few Black women did, few Black people did, few people that were, you know, from literally this Black outback, you know, manages to put herself at the center of American intellectual life.
That's Victoria Bond. She's the co-author of a terrific middle grades trilogy of novels about Hurston, Zora and Me. We talk with her about the last in the series, Zora and Me, The Summoner. Then we talk with 90-year-old Irene Butter about her spellbinding memoir of living through the Nazi Holocaust. It's called Shores Beyond Shores. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Zora Neale Hurston was one of the 20th century's greatest American writers. Best known for her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, she was also an anthropologist and a filmmaker. But once, she was a young girl. And it's Hurston's childhood that forms the core of the Zora and Me trilogy, co-authored by my guest Victoria Bond and T.R. Simon. They co-wrote the first novel in the series, Zora and Me. Simon wrote the second novel, Zora and Me, The Cursed Ground. And Victoria Bond wrote the last, Zora and Me, The Summoner. In addition to being page-turning whodunits, the books each take up important themes illuminating Black life in America, the Jim Crow South, and the remarkable resilience of the residents of the first incorporated Black town in America, Eatonville, Florida, where Zora Neale Hurston grew up. Victoria Bond, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here.
So we are talking to you about the third and final in a trilogy, the Zora and Me trilogy. But we should really talk a bit about all three of them just to give the context to our listeners. This is a series that features Zora Neale Hurston, although she is not the authorial voice, in at least not in the book that I read, Zora and Me, The Summoner. First of all, give us a sense of the whole of the trilogy, the setting,
sure,
the main characters, and some common themes. And let's start a little bit with a little bit about who Zora Neale Hurston was, although I'll ask you more about her later.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, for your listeners who may not know, Zora Neale Hurston is one of the most important American writers of the 20th century. She actually studies to be an anthropologist, and a lot of her books are anthropological works. But today she's most known for her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which was misunderstood in some, you know, literary quarters when it was first published. We have Zora Neale Hurston's work today in part because the author Alice Walker in the 1970s, you know, went on this journey of locating Zora's grave. So Alice Walker got interested in Zora Neale Hurston. And again, you know, she writes this piece and about visiting Zora's grave, putting a marker on it. And from there, Zora Neale Hurston remains in the cultural conversation and the zeitgeist and college classes and all that kind of stuff. But Zora Neale Hurston, the child, is the personality or the voice that really inspired the series. And Zora Neale Hurston is actually born in 1891, and her parents are these upstarts, and they decide that they're going to move from Alabama to Florida. And they're not just moving to Florida, they're moving to Eatonville, Florida, which is one of the first all-Black incorporated towns. So Zora grows up in this place at the turn of the century where there's a Black mayor. Her father actually becomes the mayor of Eatonville in the 1890s. There's a Black marshal. She's surrounded by Black business owners, farmers, men who own their own property. And she really does get this sense of Black people just being people, because in her life, in her community, she saw Black people just operate as they would without having the knee of racism and white supremacy, you know, on their backs. So she's this charismatic kind of tomboy girl, and she has this interest in people. She has this interest in literature and writing from a very young age. One of the things that I most love about Zora's autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, is that at the beginning, she talks a little bit about the books that she read as a child and the stories that she was really inspired by and that captured her imagination. So Zora is from this special place, and she's this talented little girl, and her mother dies. And when her mother dies, her family really does split apart. And she's sent to a boarding school, and her father stops paying the bill. And for about 10 years, there is a kind of unknown in Zora's life. She says that she was made in a theater company. You know, she also mentioned working for a circus, right? So she's kind of traveling, and she's not in school, but it's clear that she survived. And when Zora comes back on to the historical record, she is enrolling in high school in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. And to do so, she says that she's 10 years younger than she actually is, right? So it's like a funny movie. Like, you know, I could imagine, you know, Sandra Bullock in like the 90s version of this story, right? It's like someone pretending to be 16 when they're really 26. So, but she does this in order to enroll in high school, because this was how important education was. And Zora knew, for the kind of life she wanted, the life of the mind, that she would need to go back to high school. And she, you know, lied about her age, and she did that. And then she went to Howard University, and then she became the first Black graduate of Barnard College, all studying anthropology, you know. And Zora is also known now as a kind of a luminary of the Harlem Renaissance, you know. But even during that time, Zora is mostly doing anthropological work, though she is writing short stories and she does write these novels. You know, if you put all of her books on a shelf, most of them would be those kind of travelogue, anthropological kind of folklore books. So she's just doesn't see any barriers, doesn't see a river that she can't manage to cross over. And she just does her own thing at a time when few women did, at a time when few Black women did, few Black people did, few people that were, you know, from literally this Black outback, you know, manages to put herself at the center of American intellectual life for a time. It's just an extraordinary story. And Tanya and I decided that we would want to bring kind of the origin story of that larger than life figure. We would want to give her to kids.
And you do an amazing job. Now, wasn't she, I think I read recently that Zora Neale Hurston also did interviews with some of the last living slaves?
Yes. Yes. You know, Zora for a time worked with the WPA. And while she was doing that work, she recorded a lot of folklore. There was a book that came out about 2 years ago now called Barracoon, which was Zora's account of the last person from Africa enslaved here. And what her life has done for American letters, for American culture, is that because Zora lived and wrote, we have all this documentation of what Black people experienced in the 19th and in the 20th century that we wouldn't have if a woman named Zora hadn't traveled through the South and collected these stories.
So, I mean, do you think that growing up in a town like Eatonville contributed to the kind of grit and independence that and courage that Zora Neale Hurston had?
Absolutely. I think it was just the pure luck with that someone with her talents and interests got born in this place that could convince her she could pursue them. You know, I think all across the world, all across time and history, there are these, you know, these magnificent little spirits come into being. And I think too often those magnificent little spirits realize that their potential is limited by their circumstances. And I think because Zora was from Eatonville, she never felt that. She never learned that. And I think that that's in part the key to her success. You know, Eatonville, Florida was, I think, the most fun thing to work with over the course of the series, you know, because of course there is, you know, this magnificent little girl, Zora, and this is her origin story. But I loved writing the community of Eatonville, Florida. I loved digging into Zora's own work about Eatonville and then kind of deciding how I would alter or speak in dialogue or invent something altogether different than what Zora indicated about the community. You know, I feel like in a way, there's Zora as the protagonist. There's her best friend, Carrie, who is the narrator of these books. And then there's the town of Eatonville that I think is kind of the third most important player in the world of the trilogy.
Yes, and it comes vividly to life in this wonderful series, Zora and Me. And we are talking about the third in the series, The Summoner. So as you say, the narrator in the book is Carrie. Tell us about her.
Well, you know, Carrie is shy and she's a little bit resigned and, you know, she's more of an observer sometimes than a talker. And she, in the third book, she starts working, you know, as would have been the norm then. And she's probably a little bit old, actually, to start having a job. But she becomes a laundress and she lives alone with her mother. Her father, some years ago, went on a harvesting kind of migrant job and never returned home. And Carrie, as a character and the voice of these books, really embodies the friend that I wish the real Zora Neale Hurston would have had and been able to have kept in life. You know, just that warm embrace of home that I think so many of us find in our friends is what Carrie represents. And that is something that was missing from the real Zora's life. So we wanted to give Zora a friend that could tell her story.
Oh, that's beautiful. So this story begins in 1905, the story of Victoria Bond. It begins with a pretty shocking event. It starts with a lynching, and somebody says in the book, Eatonville was bound to become a source of anxiety and envy for white folks sooner or later. So talk about what happens in the beginning and how that, you know, what was the relationship of Eatonville to the surrounding white areas?
Well, I think this is something around the social unrest and the demands for social justice over last summer that has kind of put some spotlight on the history of Black towns and settlements. I think the Oklahoma case of the Greenwood neighborhood that was around Tulsa that was decimated. It was known as Black Wall Street. So, you know, that's just an example. Eatonville is another kind of example. But these places were both a kind of oasis and a respite for Black people because they could conduct business amongst themselves with fairness at the forefront. And what happened is that these places would then become targets because they were prosperous and successful, and there are a lot of prosperous, successful Black people all gathered close together. By destroying one of these communities or putting one of these communities under attack, you could really wipe out the economic gains, you know, of many Black people over a pretty probably long period of time, right? So if there are powers, white supremacist powers in a community that for many reasons, both economic, both status-wise, don't want other Black people to get the idea that they can be an upstart, that, you know, there are jobs to be had that don't involve, you know, serving white people or farming land for a white owner, then, you know, these places really, they have to go, right? They present this alternate reality that white supremacy has tried to convince Black people through violence and through other means can't exist and doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So in Florida specifically, you know, Eatonville was not so much, you know, accepted as much as it was tolerated. And I think, you know, the history of these communities over time has shown they have become the places that the highway gets cut through, you know, or that gets sold off to developers for XYZ reasons. So, you know, there's all of that. Now, why I chose to start the book with a lynching is that I wanted to show that a place like Eatonville would not only be a target for white supremacist powers, but it would also be a beacon. You know, it would be a place that people on the run, fugitives, you know, chain gangs were rampant throughout the South and all over the country at that time, that it would be a place that someone on the run could feel like there was a chance he could survive or receive shelter. So I wanted to kind of play up those two aspects as both target and beacon.
I actually went online to find out about Eatonville, and it does still exist.
Yeah.
So this is an escaped convict. He gets lynched. But there's questions about how welcoming he will be in that community, because to take him in puts so many people at risk. Eventually, it kind of becomes a moot point. But those kinds of tensions, or even the abuse of power, doesn't necessarily go away just because all the characters are Black or you're in a Black town. So mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how power plays out in the town, you know, across maybe other identities, gender and otherwise.
Well, I think that was one of the kind of the surprises of the novel for me, is that it ended up being a lot about how power plays out in a kind of civic context. And it just so happened, you know, my civic context was in this early 20th century Black town. So there is the sheriff, the marshal, who is also the mayor of the town, Joe Clark, and he's been the longtime leader. There's been no one else that has held this position in the town. And the real Joe Clark was a co-founder of Eatonville. And Joe Clark is very much of the mind that this horrible thing happened. We have to move on from it, however horrible it was. We don't have the power in this system to stand up against it. But what we do have the power to do is try to literally expand the territory of our town, right? So this lynching occurred. These people came into our town. We can make our town bigger. We can make our town stronger. The way that we put up a fight against these kinds of shows of violence and hostility is by becoming a larger community, right? So he has that perspective. There's Zora's father and another kind of political thread throughout the town that is actually seated by Zora's mother that is very protectionist, that is very much like, look, that man may have been, you know, running for his life. He was a fugitive from a chain gang. No one here really thinks that he did anything to deserve being in prison or to deserve execution, right? But he was a stranger. He doesn't belong here. We have to protect our own, and being open to expansion, being open to, you know, being a beacon or a safe haven for whatever reason, that puts us at risk.
Well, he's an interesting figure, Zora's father. He's not a particularly sympathetic character, but he himself, you know, went through some pretty intense struggles and became, you know, succeeded in life, a very ambitious man. Is he based on the actual person?
Yes, he is absolutely based on Zora's father. She had a tough relationship with him, which I think all three books convey. Zora's first novel is called Jonas Gourdvine. And that was a book I really thought a lot about while I was writing The Summoner, because Zora's father, a character based on Zora's father, is the protagonist of that novel. And it's really amazing that Zora Neale Hurston, the writer, could write her father with so much empathy and compassion, especially given what their relationship was like. So that was one thing that really impressed, you know, me as a human being, to know that, you know, there was very little that Zora agreed on with her father, but yet she makes him such a full human being in that novel.
And I think you've done the same thing, Victoria Bond, in this book as well, in Zora and Me, The Summoner. Now, there's another issue that has really, that you take up in this book that also has real salience for what's going on today in the midst of a pandemic. And that is a whole issue of medical research, you know, the use of black bodies for medical research. There is a grave that is robbed here. There are people called the Resurrection Men who are suspected. Talk about what are you referring to there, and then what is the relevance to what's happening today with the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, yeah, one of the most kind of spine tingling in a bad way bits of research that I discovered writing this book is that in the 19th century, around the creation of medical schools and medical research facilities, there was a real demand for corpses and cadavers to conduct medical research. And, you know, this became such a problem that laws were passed to bar research on white cadavers, right? So since grave robbery was, you know, such this horrible, gross, sacrilegious crime, you know, people said we've had enough, but that didn't make the need for cadavers go away. So the industry of like grave robbing and resurrection men began to focus on black cemeteries. There's a lot of scholarship, you know, that documents the bodies of enslaved people, Black enslaved people being carted in barrels of whiskey, you know, on train trips from the Deep South up through the North, with these barrels being delivered to medical schools. So once you learn something like this, you're just like, what? Like, some of the, you know, most meaningful research of the late 19th century happened like almost exclusively on Black bodies. Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. So once I found this out, I was like, oh my gosh, like I have to get this in the book, because, you know, medical research, you know, whether it's the Tuskegee Institute, those experiments, you know, around syphilis in the earlier part of the 20th century, or even, you know, now, you know, communities of color being, you know, very intense in their questioning around the COVID vaccine, you know, the disproportionate numbers of people of color, you know, experiencing death from COVID, you know, all of this stuff is of a piece with each other. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you know, if I'm going to have a grave robbery in my book, it shouldn't just have, you know, these links to this kind of hoodoo kind of threads in the Black diaspora and African-American and Afro-Caribbean life and history. I should try to link it to something that's as current now, unfortunately, as it's ever been, which is Black people in medicine.
Yeah. And I, you know, I heard Michael Steele, who was the former head of the Republican Party, you're saying, well, it's a long time from Tuskegee, and that vaccine actually has been partially developed by a Black woman. But what you're really showing in this book, Victoria Bond, in Azora and Me, The Summoner, is that history keeps its dead hand on the throat of the present for a very long time.
That's right.
Now, finally, the book has a prologue. It's a letter from Carrie, the narrator, more than 50 years later, 1956. To her granddaughter, where she says the following, and I just love this. She says, "Fear no loss. Despite our efforts, loss touches us all. Stand brave, dear girl. Loss will not be your undoing. Loss cannot hold a candle to love. Love is our story." So tell us where that came from.
Oh my goodness. You know, each of the books has a prologue, and each of them is about an aspect of the story itself. And with this one, I wanted to try to write to the reader. You know, I wanted to acknowledge the reader in a more concrete way. And I just thought, if I could give a message of this story to the reader, right? What is the message of this story? That would be it. You know, so that was just, you know, me, the author, trying to use a device in order to speak to the reader as directly as I could.
Oh, and I love that. And, you know, this is something I'm going to quote this to my granddaughter. It's that good.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Well, it's just been a delight to talk with you, Victoria Bond, about Zora and Me, The Summoner, the final book in the series of Zora and Me. The other ones are Zora and Me, Zora and Me, The Cursed Ground, and this is The Summoner. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for having me.
Victoria Bond teaches first-year writing at John Jay College, the City University of New York. Zora and Me won the John Steptoe Coretta Scott King Award for New Talent and was nominated for an Edgar Award in the category of juvenile fiction. Next up, a remarkable story of survival and resilience. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The ranks of Holocaust survivors is thinning rapidly. people who have a perspective on the lived horrors of fascism and xenophobia in Nazi-dominated Europe. One of them is Irene Butter, who turned 90 last week. Born in Germany, she fled with her family to the Netherlands, where they expected to be safe from Nazi persecution. That, of course, didn't happen. When the Nazis occupied Holland, Irene Butter's family, parents, brother, and her, ended up shipped off to the Nazi concentration camp Bergen-Belsen. By January 1945, the family was struggling to survive. Irene, all of 14 years old, took care of her ailing parents, starving kids in the camp, and even helped bring clothes to her Amsterdam neighbor Anne Frank before her family was offered a singular chance for freedom. Butter's first-person memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, is an account of how the heart keeps its common humanity in the most inhumane and turbulent of times, and her hard-earned lessons are a timeless inspiration. Irene Butter, welcome to Writer's Voice. You opened this memoir in 1936. You were 6 years old. You had an older brother, Werner, who was a little more aware of what was going on. What was it like for you as a very little girl to experience Germany's descent into full-on persecution of Jews?
The first 6 years of my life, I had an idyllic childhood. And then all of a sudden, I was awakened by the fact that we had to escape. We had to leave the homeland because my grandfather owned a bank. My father was partner in the bank, and the Nazis decided that Jews couldn't own banks, and it was taken away. My father was unemployed, and so he decided one day to go to Amsterdam and try to find a job there, because the Netherlands was neutral during World War I, and he expected it would be neutral again, and we could escape Hitler and be safe. So he did find a job with American Express in Amsterdam. But first of all, he was gone for 3 months, and I missed him terribly. And when finally we were going to join him, we had to leave my grandparents behind. And I grew up with them in the same house and was very attached to them. They were very loving and spoiled my brother and me to pieces. And so this became very tense. My mother had to get a lot of papers ready for our departure from Germany. And leaving my grandparents behind was just devastating. So when we got on the train, on the one hand, I was so elated because I'd missed my dad and I was going to see him again. And then I was torn away from these grandparents. So that was a big shock. And then
so you were torn away from your grandparents, who you loved very much. Your background was a comfortable one. Your father was a banker. Talk about your parents. I mean, they just come across in this memoir as amazing. I mean, truly remarkable and courageous and resilient people.
Well, they managed to hold up hope and protect my brother and me and keep us going until the point, well, my father did everything to save the family. First of all, to leave Germany and get settled in Holland. But then 2 years after we arrived in the Netherlands, the Nazis invaded and Holland became an occupied country. And the escalation, the deportation of Jews escalated and life became very difficult almost overnight.
Yeah, that's so true. But tell us what they were like. Like, tell us your father's character, your mother's character. Give us a description of your parents.
Yeah, my father was very, very strong and lovable. He had that combination of characteristics of strength and integrity, and yet he was very soft and sensitive and loving. And I don't remember him ever yelling at me or punishing me for anything in my early childhood. And I'm sure I was naughty at times. My mother also had a lot of stamina. She was a very dedicated mother. And she was the one, I think, who wanted to protect us most from, you know, from not knowing what was going on, not knowing how bad things were and what the future might hold. And that kind of security meant a lot, especially when we were in the concentration camps. I remember arriving in Bergen-Belsen, and at the train station, we were met by Nazis with big German shepherds that were barking, and if they hadn't been held on leashes, they would have jumped on us, and I don't know what they would have done, but tear us apart. And my mother said to me, "Barking dogs don't bite." I'll never forget that. I was so scared of these dogs getting off the train. But with all their strength and love and protection and providing security for my brother and myself, their health deteriorated. And then we came to a point where my brother and I had to take care of my parents because they were suffering from illnesses. My mother was bedridden for a few months. My father caught pneumonia and was hospitalized early in our stay in Bergen-Belsen. I don't think he ever recovered from that. And of course, they were subjected to hard labor. They never resisted. They had the stamina to get up at dawn every morning and go to labor, regardless of the weather, regardless of lack of food, and in fear, because a lot of times the Nazis beat people because they weren't producing what they were expected to produce under those hard conditions. I definitely think that it is my parents who gave me the resilience to hold on and to survive.
Yes, that comes across very clearly in Shores Beyond Shores. As you said, you settled in Amsterdam, you thought you were safe, and then in May of 1940, the Germans invaded Holland. You said something really striking, and that is that as a child, you write, "What did I know of war? The meaning slipped through my fingers no matter how serious it sounded. But not the bombs. This was war I could feel in my bones." Talk about how you felt as a child when the world that you felt had been safe crumbled around you.
Well, it was very frightening because in the first few days of the invasion, there were many bombings and planes crashing. And at that time, one night, there was a bomb dropped in Amsterdam, not far from our neighborhood, and our windows shattered. And while we had these very heavy curtains, also because you couldn't have any light show in the nighttime, it had to be all darkened, blocked out. And so even through these heavy curtains, some of the glass ended up in our beds, and that was really scary. That was the real hardcore experience with war, when you wake up with this incredible noise of crashing bombs and planes, and then you have the windows shatter in your bed.
Oh, that's just incredible. Yes. And then you say that the changes were slow, that the Jews, you know, decree came after decree, life became more restricted for Jews. First you had to give up your bicycles, then you couldn't visit the parks, then you couldn't ride the trams. You were actually taken out of the regular school and had to go to a Jewish school. Talk about that, and then talk about what happened. One day, you're in school, and all of a sudden, you're called out by the principal.
Yes, right. Yeah, all the gradual restrictions, of course, they came slowly, and that made the impact somehow more spread out rather than having everything happened within 1 week. But having to go to the Jewish school was not pleasant at all. First of all, it was much further from my home than the neighborhood school, and I didn't have a bicycle anymore, so I had to walk quite a distance every day. But one gets used to it. What was more tragic than being isolated from the friends I had made in the other school was that in the Jewish school, every week, more and more of the school benches were empty because the families had either gone into hiding or, more likely, they were deported. And so after a while, the class was half empty. And of course, we knew why it was half empty. And all of that installed a lot of fear. What was going to happen to us? When are we next lined up for deportation?
And so then it happened. You were called out and you had to go home, and your family were sent to a place called, in Amsterdam, a gathering point for Jews before they were being sent to the first transit camp, the Hollandse Schouwburg. That was had been a theater that you'd actually been to before it was made into this terrible gathering place. You saw a newborn infant ripped from her mother. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, the babies, the little children, were put across the street from the theater in a sort of a little children's home because of this hall in the theater was dark and there was no air and it was dusty. It wasn't a place for babies. So they allowed the babies to be taken care of in this house across the street. And then one day, one of the guards, Nazi guards, one asked me if I wanted to go across the street and play with the children. And that's when I saw this horrible scene where a mother was allowed to come and nurse her baby three times a day, I think. And then she couldn't keep the baby with her. It was torn away from her when she tried to take it with her back to the theater. And that's the utmost cruelty that I remember, is how the Nazis responded to babies.
Yes, and we've seen that very same kind of thing today here in this country at the border. I just wonder, when you heard about the children, the babies being, you know, ripped from their mother's breasts at the U.S. border with Mexico.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, it's just unfathomable for me to think that 75 years later, this would happen in our country here in America, that, you know, that the world has not learned from the Holocaust, from all this cruelty, this barbarism. And these children here at the border were put into cages, and nobody kept track of the children or the parents. And when they try to reunify them, they can't do it because they have no idea where the parents would be to reclaim their children. It's incomprehensible. It gives me nightmares, and I cannot understand how this can happen these days.
Yes. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with 90-year-old Holocaust survivor Irene Butter about her spellbinding memoir, Shores Beyond Shores. So, remarkably, you were released from the theater, the Hollandse Schouwburg. You and your parents returned home for a while. Why didn't your parents then take the opportunity to hide, you know, to do what Anne Frank's father did?
Right. Well, hiding was not that easy. It wasn't that simple. You had to find a place, a family that would take you in. That's one thing. And while there were many people who found hiding places, it certainly wasn't simple. And secondly, you had to have a lot of money, because once you're in hiding, you cannot pick up your rationing cards. And that's how you were able to get food, was with these coupons, these rationing coupons, so all the food had to be purchased on the black market, and it meant having a lot of money. And then thirdly, my father did try, but he couldn't find a place that would take our family. He found a place for my father and mother and a place for my brother and me. And when he presented us with that possibility, my brother and I refused. We said we wouldn't go if we couldn't be together, and never found the right place. Now, of course, going into hiding wasn't necessarily the better choice, because look what happened to Anne Frank and her family and many other families who were betrayed and sent to Auschwitz directly. So in times of war like that, it's very hard to figure out what is the best choice.
Yeah, that's for sure. And in fact, if I'm correct on this, when the Franks were sent to Westerbork, they were sent to the punishment part of the camp because they'd been in hiding.
Right. Yes, that's what happened when people were discovered or betrayed. And as a matter of fact, what they did, the Nazis, they gave everybody a T-shirt, and it had a big, huge capital S on the back of the shirt, and S as a symbol for Strafe, which is punishment. And you see tiny little children, babies and little toddlers with a shirt that has an S on the back. So if that wasn't cruelty, I don't know what would be. Label a baby for punishment.
Yeah, and that's an example of a detail that I've never seen before. And it just underscores that when in reading your memoir and other memoirs like this, it's a real different experience. It's as if you're reading it from the inside instead of as a kind of historical reporting. It makes it so much more vivid. So, Irene Butter, talk about Bergen-Belsen. In this book, Shores Beyond Shores, you write about taking care of children there, small children. What were the kids like? How did they behave?
It was a very sad job to take care of these children because, first of all, many of them were little and they were uncomfortable without their mom. Their parents, which happened every day from early morning till into the evening, they didn't have their parents, and it made them feel insecure and fearful. And secondly, many of them were ill because everybody in Bergen-Belsen was sick at one point or another because of the minimal nutrition provided and the deplorable hygienic conditions and epidemics of disease. So some of these children were sick. They had fever, they had diarrhea, and they were hungry. And we had no food to give them. There were no toys to play with. There was no food to give them. All we could do is hold them and snuggle them and love them and try to give them some comfort in that way.
You also saw Anne Frank there.
Yes, just on one occasion I did, because Anna and her sister Margot had, when Auschwitz was closed, they were sent to Bergen-Belsen. There were several hundred women who came from Auschwitz. And first they lived in tents because there were no barracks available. And then barracks were built for them. We were separated by barbed wire. We weren't allowed to be close to the wire. But a close friend of Anne Frank, Hannelie Goslar, had become a friend of mine because we lived in the same barrack. And one day she was walking near the barbed wire and she heard people speak Dutch. So she asked them whether Anne Frank by any chance was there. And someone went to fetch her and she came to the fence. This was at night because it's only nighttime that everything was dark and the guards in the watchtowers wouldn't see you. Otherwise, they could shoot you because it wasn't allowed to be near that fence. And so she saw her and she was very pale and very emaciated, and she didn't have clothes. All she had was a gray blanket wrapped around her. So Anna said, gee, if you could get me some clothes, that would be wonderful. And she came back, Hanna Lee came back to the barrack and told me about it. And I helped gather some clothing because they never took away our clothing in Bergen-Belsen. And so the next evening, we went back to the fence together and threw a bundle of clothing over the fence. But it was dark, and a woman came and picked up the bundle and ran off with it. But then my family and I left on this exchange transport 2 days later. So I never saw Anna again, but Hanna Lee told me many, many years later that she had thrown another bundle over the fence, and Anna did get the second bundle of clothing. But she and her sister Margot had typhus, and that's how both of them died in the camp. And I can't imagine that she lived much beyond the time when I saw her, because she was so skinny and so ill.
It's heartbreaking. Yes, and then the amazing story of you being able to leave on this exchange. How did that come about? You know, I have to say that your parents were very resilient and resourceful. You also had, in the midst of terrible luck, you had the most incredible luck.
Yes. And I always describe it as a miracle, because I can't really understand it in any other way, because my mother had been bedridden for at least 2 months, maybe 3 months, and I had been taken care of her, and she hadn't been out of bed at all. And that day, when the announcement came around that everybody with a South American passport had to report to a doctor, because there would be an exchange transport. And that's why we were in Bergen-Belsen. This camp was a camp for people who had papers, passports, visas, or American citizenship to be used by the Germans as exchange for German citizens. And that's why we were there. And it was almost 1 year when this announcement came around. And so my father was at work, at labor, and my mother was sick in bed. So my brother and I dressed my mother, and we tried to take her to this place where there was a doctor screening people for the transport. And she couldn't make it. She collapsed before we even got there, and we had to take her back to bed. And then my father came. Oh, and then my brother and I went, and the doctor checked off our names, and he said, be ready, you'll leave tomorrow on an exchange transport. And so then we went back to the barrack, and my father came back from labor, and he looked terrible. He looked ill, and he was exhausted, and we wanted him to go with me to this doctor, and he said he couldn't. He was sick, and he was exhausted, and he needed to rest, so he rested for a while. And then my brother and I begged with him to come, and he was leaning heavily on me, and we made it to this doctor, and he asked my father, are you John Hausenberg? He said, yes. The doctor said, are you ill? He said, no. And then he looked at me, and he checked off my father's name and my mother's name, and he said, tomorrow you'll be leaving the camp.
Right. He thought you were your mother. And in fact, your father, you say, had just been the victim of a vicious beating.
Yeah, we didn't know that until later, but that's what happened that morning.
Right. Talk about these passports. I mean, you had somehow gotten these passports when you were back in Amsterdam, but they weren't real passports?
No, they were fake. Well, my father had written to a man in Stockholm, because a friend had told him that he received Ecuadorian passports from this person. So my father wrote a letter, and included 4 passport pictures, and these passports did not come. We were already in Westerbork, and the passports arrived at our home address in Amsterdam, and they were forwarded to Westerbork. And I call that a miracle, too, because we never got any mail forwarded from Amsterdam to Westerbork except that package. And that's the only time I remember my parents smiling in Westerbork when the package came with these passports. And so when we were sent from Westerbork to Bergen-Belsen, they told us, Bergen-Belsen is a better camp, and you won't be there long because you're going to be exchanged. And here we are almost 1 year later, you know, barely, my parents were barely alive. And there's an exchange transport, but out of several thousand people who had passports, they selected only 103 people, and my family was included.
Amazing. So you got released from Bergen-Belsen. You are put on a train to Switzerland. Your father made it to freedom, but that was all he made it to.
Right. Well, we were on a train to be exchanged for German, mostly German civilians who were in America, had been here since before the war, and were in internment camp in Texas and were used for this exchange. There probably were some prisoners of war, but I don't know. I never really saw the figures. And these people were living happily in America and without any choice on their part, were sent back to Germany. Germany still in war, in times of war and scarcities and bombings and you name it. And so we were put on this train, and it was destined for a city at the border of Switzerland. The exchange took place in the night, and then the next day the train arrived in Switzerland. The passports were not valid. The Swiss had too many refugees. They didn't want to keep us, so the journey did not end there, but my father died 2 days before we arrived in Switzerland, and that was a terrible shock.
Yes, I can imagine that. In fact, though, your mother and brother were quite ill, and they did spend some time in Switzerland, and then all of you finally made it out. We'll leave the rest of the story to our listeners to find out when they read your wonderful book, Shores Beyond Shores. Irene Butter, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and a very happy 90th birthday tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
Here's a Writer's Voice book pick for the holidays. Ellen Cooney writes heartwarming and thought-provoking novels and stories that often feature dogs as a key part of the plot. Her latest novel is true to form. One Night, Two Souls is the story of a hospital chaplain who's joined one night by an unusual companion, a dog that might or might not be a ghost. This becomes a vehicle for the novel's linked stories of people living their last moments, and the healing and inspiration those stories provide for the chaplain herself. It's a great read and a balm for these very difficult times. That's Ellen Cooney's novel, One Night, Two Souls. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.